This is December 7th, 2008. And today's Teisho will be on the Bardo. The Bardo is a Tibetan word, a word in Tibetan Buddhism, or actually it's Tibetan, period. Most commonly refers to the period after death, before rebirth, this intermediate state of existence. According to Buddhist teaching, when the body perishes, we aren't immediately reborn, but instead there is this this in-between state before rebirth. And that's the most common definition of bardo, the in-between. Bar means just that. Bar means in-between, and do means suspended or thrown. I was pointed in the direction of this topic by my awareness that with this recession, this really very serious financial crisis that we're in, that it really is a kind of a bardo. It's a transition. That's the larger meaning of bardo. It's a transition from one state to another. I dug up an article that I cut out a while ago. I don't even know. It's from Tricycle Magazine. I don't have a date on here. And it's called Awakening in the Bardo. And I think it's several articles, but the one I'll be reading from is called The Luminous Gap of Bardo. And this is written by Francesca Freemantle. He's a PhD who studied Sanskrit and Tibetan before meeting Chogyam Trungpa, with whom she collaborated in translating the Tibetan Book of the Dead. First, a general introduction here to these several articles. It says, the bardo, or the in-between, has come to describe the transitional state between death and rebirth, but its qualities also characterize the gap arising between any two states. In fact, we live in a continuous bardo, forever suspended between past and future, although we seldom recognize it. While the bardo may bring with it great uncertainty and discomfort, teachers and practitioners in the following essays guide us through the unique opportunity for awakening it offers. So I must have thought that just this one article that I'll be reading was the best of a lot, and because it's the only one I saved. So here is this woman, Francesca Freemantle. Bardo can have many implications depending on how one looks at it. It is an interval, a hiatus, a gap. It can act as a boundary that divides and separates, marking the end of one thing and the beginning of another. But it can also be a link between the two. It can serve as a bridge or a meeting place, which brings together and unites. It is a crossing, a stepping stone, a transition. By the way, just to broaden our understanding of this current crisis, I see it as just part of a much more vast shift in geopolitics and the whole thing of globalism, the global economy. So it's not just the U.S. Well, we know this. This is spreading all through many other countries, this financial crisis. But it would be a mistake to see it only in financial terms. It's something much bigger. Some have said this. Amala Sensei emailed me from from New Zealand that week when in September when things really started going south, and said that some prominent political or religious leader there said, we're seeing a shift from the American to the Chinese as the empire, the dominant empire of the world. Well, we'll see. China's not doing great either through this financial crisis, but I do have a sense that that something big is happening here. Again, back to the article, it is a crossing, a stepping stone, a transition. It is a crossroads where one must choose which path to take, and it is a no man's land, belonging neither to one side nor to the other. It is a highlight or peak point of experience, and at the same time a situation of extreme tension, caught between two opposites. It is an open space filled with an atmosphere of suspension and uncertainty, neither this nor that. In such a state, one may feel confused and frightened, or one may feel surprisingly liberated and open to new possibilities where anything might happen. Goes on, such moments as these occur continuously in our life, unrecognized, and this is the inner significance of the bardo states. Trungpa Rinpoche spoke of them as periods of uncertainty between sanity and insanity, or between the confusion of samsara and the transformation of confusion into wisdom. They are the heightened qualities of different types of ego and the possibility of getting off ego. That's where bardo starts, the peak experience in which there is the possibility of losing the grip of ego and the possibility of being swallowed up in it. I think one of the most striking experiences of this transition, and that is both the possibility of losing the grip of ego and the possibility of being swallowed up in it, is the experience of, I mean, besides the obvious of dying, is the experience of going to Sesshin. Sesshin, because it is such an unusual, unusually obvious case of going into the unknown. It is really a perfect analog for death, entering death, because that's really what death is, isn't it? It's nobody knows what happens after death. And our fear of death is the fear of the unknown. Or you could also say it's a fear of not being, disappearing. But I think in the case of going to Sesshin, it's the fear of the unknown, because certainly if it's your first Sesshin, it's unknown. You know that that you don't know what's going to happen in there. But even for subsequent sesshins, now you really know you don't know what's going to happen there. And I've come to understand that many people. Many people have anxiety. We know from forever here at this center that in the days leading up to Sesshin, the anxiety level here on staff steadily rises and comes out in all kinds of ways. But I'm convinced from all of my discussions with people and all that this is a more or less universal phenomenon about going into Sesshin. It's a time of uncertainty and fear and anxiety. Some people have more of it than others. Of course, as the more Sesshins you've been to, the less likely you're going to have anxiety or fear, or it gets more and more mild. But it also, if we really pay attention, we can see that we are, in those days or hours leading up to the opening ceremony of Sesshin, we can see that we are in a heightened state of awareness. And that's where the promise comes. That's the possibility there, where we are in a heightened state. He goes on, wherever there is the death of one state of mind, there is the birth of another. And linking the two, there is bardo. So we could say that really, as she says, this goes on all the time. And we see it clearly when we're doing Zazen. We see how states of mind come and go, how we are continually transitioning from one thought form or absence of a thought form, from one state of consciousness into another, and back and forth from the various states of consciousness into this state of no mind that is the pure absorption in our practice. Zazen is experiencing dying, second by second, breath by breath, millisecond by millisecond. Because this is really what dying is. It's change. It's moving from one state to another. So sitting is the perfect practice at learning how to die. And the ultimate sitting, ultimate of that, form of that, is Sesshin, because it's so intense, there's so much sitting. And this means that we become more and more acutely aware of these transitions, of this flux of the mind, the passing states of mind. Wherever there is the death of one state of mind, there is the birth of another, and linking the two, there is bardo. The past has gone, and the future has not yet come. We cannot catch that in-between moment, yet it really is all there is. In other words, it is present experience, the immediate experience of nowness, where you are, where you're at. The six bardos are I'm not going to read this. This different kinds of bardos that I don't think we have time to get into. I'll do my own enumeration of various kinds of bardos later. These states can last for a short or a long period of time, as long as a whole lifetime in the case of the first. Yet they all share the mysterious and immensely powerful quality of in-betweenness. Buddha was once asked, what is the length of a human life? And he said that the space between the end of one breath and the beginning of the other, the beginning of the next. She goes on, or we could say that by learning to see these stages of our life as bardos, we can gain access to that power which is always present, unnoticed, in every moment of existence itself. Now this is the key thing, is to wake up to these moments of possibility where we really do, the possibility is that we can be free of thoughts, which means free of past and future. Because there is no past except in our thoughts, our memories. And there's no future except in our thoughts. And when we are free of thoughts, when we are dwelling in no mind, then this is the greatest opportunity to awaken, either in the kind of orthodox sense of awakening, of kensho, or just having insights of one kind or another. She goes on, the experiences of the bardos do not exist of themselves. They arise from the open space of the primordial nature of mind. Luminosity is the aspect of mind that gives rise to all these appearances. It is the environment that surrounds them, out of which they emerge and into which they dissolve. She's talking about what in Zen we could call no mind. It is always present, like the sun in the sky, hidden behind clouds. At the moment, because of ignorance of our real nature, we experience everything as the confused manifestations of samsara. The sense of self creates a feeling of solidity, like the apparent solidity of the clouds veiling the face of the sun. But at certain moments, a gap is opened up, through which we may receive a glimpse of the light of reality. We have countless opportunities to see this gap between what has happened and what has yet to happen, between this and that. In our daily life, there are these transitions, starting off when we wake up in the morning and we're still in bed. There's a very obvious transition and a moment of what many find is great clarity. Personally, I have many, when I go to bed on a Saturday night without having worked out a topic for Taisho, I often will wake up on Sunday morning and what just that first half minute of consciousness, things just fall into place and I get a whole new fresh understanding of it and clarity about how to, what direction to go. So there's waking up and the other end, going to sleep at night. Children are often resistant to this, going to sleep. Even adults can be resistant to it. There are many people I've come to understand who just will find anything to prolong the waking state and resist just calling it a day and giving up, surrendering to the need for sleep. They're all the routines of our daily life. All of our bathroom routines are all transitions. Our meals. going to work, commuting. There's a gap. Going up and down the stairs. And then the sitting. Sitting down. And then that moment when time is up and we unfold our legs and stand up right there. Perfect opportunity for paying attention and not just capitulating to the thoughts that can rush up at that moment. Same with kinhin. How many people really use kinhin as a seamless continuation of the practice? These moments of transition, either getting up from the mat, starting kinhin, ending kinhin, sitting back down, going out to the car, getting in the car, getting out of the car. This is where thoughts can so easily take over the mind, and at the same time, opportunities where we can refrain from filling up the holes and just be fully present. There are weekly transitions from the ones around weekends and weekdays. Monday mornings are difficult for so many people. Friday afternoons or evenings are obvious transitions that many people get all excited about and can also be depressing for people. There are monthly transitions and accompanying bardos, monthly rhythms, women with their periods, New Year's Eve is the big one, the big obvious an analog for, in terms of schedules, the big counterpart to death and rebirth, other annual events. Passages of becoming a parent. Getting married, wedding, divorce, breaking up in a relationship, any kind of losses. These are the really, really rich possibilities of seeing beyond the world of flux, of states, beyond states. We heard a couple days ago that there are the highest number of people who lost jobs in 34 years, over 500,000 people. Losing a job is a kind of a death. Still, one of the most painful memories I have is once in college. During the summer, I went around trying to find a job, and I kept count. I went to 28 different places and never found a job, and it was devastating. It was demoralizing. And look, there was nothing at stake. I had no one to support. I had no children, no anything. But it ground me down in terms of my sense of self-worth. It didn't last for very long, but it was bruising. And then I think of people who lose their jobs and can't find employment. It's one of the most potentially corrosive things for one's self-esteem, sense of self-worth. And at the same time, it's a time of great opportunity to adapt to the loss and the change and find a new approach to work. There are losses of responsibility aside from jobs. A more recent bardo I experienced was each time I authorized one of my senior disciples and one of our foreign affiliates that I had been going to for many years and saying goodbye, knowing that I would never be back there to lead a sesshin again. This happened in Sweden after 15 or 16 years of going there twice a year and forming attachments to the people there as my students. Gave me a very small, what surely is a very small experience of parents seeing their children leave home and become independent. Retirement is a challenge for many people, not everyone. These transitions are especially difficult. Are difficult to the extent that we identify with our role, our image. So if we let's say are someone of who identifies as being whatever, a builder of a house, houses, contractor, and we retire, then to the degree to which we are bound to that self-image, identify with being a builder, to that degree we will suffer. But it also, again, is a chance to shed what is not essential to us as much. Even if you've spent a whole life doing one kind of work, there's something beyond what we do for a living that is our nature. And that suddenly now is we're free of a particular, specific identification and can see what's beyond anything specific or particular. There are the inevitable losses of sickness, losing our health, losing our strength as we age, our strength, our memory. All of the standard passages, menopause, injuries, losing our attractiveness, our sexiness, our waist, our hairline, our hips, our breasts, our hair. Each one an opportunity to shake off any notion of oneself. Breaking up in relationships, divorce, abortion must be a bardo. Entering a bardo. Every time our plans or our arrangements that we've made go awry, we enter a bardo. I'm going to read from a different source for a minute. This is from the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sogyal Rinpoche. And he just says here, the bardo is a continuous, unnerving oscillation between clarity and confusion, bewilderment and insight, certainty and uncertainty, sanity and insanity. In our minds, as we are now, wisdom and confusion arise simultaneously, or, as we say, are co-emergent. This means that we face a continuous state of choice between the two, and that everything depends on which we will choose. We experience this every time we cross our legs and do zazen. This choice between wisdom and confusion. Confusion being this world of thoughts, and wisdom being no thought, the absence of thoughts, mu, the koan, the breath. He goes on, this constant uncertainty may make everything seem bleak and almost hopeless, thinking now again of this financial crisis we're in. But if you look more deeply at it, you will see that its very nature creates gaps, spaces in which profound chances and opportunities for transformation are continuously flowering. If, that is, they can be seen and seized. Well, they won't be seen if we cling to what has been. If we cling to our memories or our wishes or our hopes. So that's the key thing, is letting go. Non-clinging, non-attachment. Not because clinging and attachment are wrong. It's not a matter of right and wrong. But because we create unnecessary suffering when we cling to a state of mind, to a job, to a relationship, to the weekend when it's Monday morning, or to our children when we can't see them much anymore, or to our image as a country, as a compassionate, virtuous, powerful country. I look back at these last 8 years. It's like an 8-year bardo. The masters, he says, the masters tell us that after we die, our clarity or confusion will be multiplied by 7. This is why we have memorial services, and our memorial prayer seek to help the deceased to navigate through this confusion times 7. And with enough experience in dealing with the flux, the endless flux of mental formations through meditation, the deceased is more likely to experience clarity times 7. The zazen, which is just all that really means, the zazen just means, in its purest, just means a state free of thought forms. Zazen reveals this world of freedom from forms. The first of the Four Noble Truths is that of suffering or dissatisfaction, which really means that as long as we rely on the things of the world for fulfillment or contentment, we will be left wanting, frustrated. So long as we rely on the things of the world, that covers a lot. That, as long as we're caught in success and failure, coming and going, gain and loss, life and death, riches and poverty, anything, basically, anything, any phenomena, as long as we're relying on any kind of physical or immaterial phenomena, we will be left wanting, dissatisfied. And in our zazen, we experience this realm, we can experience this realm that is beyond phenomena. Beginning with the breath. Oh, I guess the breath is a phenomenon, but it's not a thought. It's a direct experience, not a thought about anything. In its simplicity, it is. And the more we learn to dwell in that world of formless non-attachment, or to put it maybe a better way is to put it in the negative, the more we can refrain from pursuing thought forms, which the ultimate, deepest thought form is self and other, the more we can learn to refrain from trafficking in thoughts, the easier any transition is, whether death of the physical body or any of these other losses or passages. I'm going to go back to this article by Francesca Freemantle, which I think is very, very clear and this gap is brought about by the intensity of emotional experience, which is always accompanied by an equal and opposite reaction, so that we are thrown into a situation of conflict and uncertainty. Two contrasting extremes are present simultaneously. Trungpa Rinpoche described it as being drenched with boiling hot and freezing cold water at the same time. At that very moment, there is nothing to do but let go. Give up trying to hold on to one extreme or the other. Abandon the battle between life and death, good and bad, hope and fear. Then, in that instant of relaxation, there comes a sudden flash of realization. There is always the possibility that, in the midst of an everyday situation, or at the height of some emotion, we may suddenly catch a glimpse of its essential emptiness and luminosity, a moment of sacred vision. Every moment is an opportunity to awaken, simply because that is our nature. Enlightenment is our nature. It doesn't come or go. It's our nature. Why couldn't we awaken to it at any moment if the mind is free? And we know from the stories, the accounts of awakenings by the masters and even others much more recently, that it often happens at the most ordinary moments. She goes on, entering the awakened state of mind, even for a moment, is always preceded by an experience, however fleeting, of extreme contrast and conflict. Even on the highest and most subtle levels of attainment, negative and positive continue together side by side until one makes the leap beyond them both. Deliberately inducing paradoxical situations or being confronted by paradoxical statements which the rational mind is unable to reconcile can sometimes shock a person who is ready for it into a breakthrough. Great teachers have been known to precipitate an awakening in their students by a sudden outburst of anger or some other totally unexpected action. There are many stories of this kind in tantric literature, such as when the great the great master Tilopa hit his disciple Naropa in the face with his shoe. Even in ordinary life, gaps of this kind can occur. It might happen when we are in a state of complete exhaustion, feeling that we cannot stand it any longer and are just about to tip over the edge into madness. I've seen this happen where a student will get more and more desperate and reach a state of critical mass where you feel you can't go back and you can't go forward, and then finally something opens up. Or, she says, it might come at the height of extreme emotion, when our emotional energy reaches its peak and we are suddenly no longer sure what we are doing or what caused it. These states of critical mass we access them more easily through questioning, through a koan. That is, as a practice. But of course, if life circumstances are so painful or unbearable that we just can't take it anymore, then that provides also even a better way to vault over the dichotomy that we feel trapped in, the dilemma. Suddenly time seems to stop and we feel calm and detached, suspended in a state of absolute stillness. I bet just about everyone listening to this has experienced that, at least a fleeting second or two. You're in some kind of desperate state trying to get somewhere on time, or where something terrible happens in your family, or happens to you, or some loss, a theft, where things suddenly get very still, and time stops. There's the in-between state. There's the opportunity. For a moment, we enter a different dimension of being, but without training, it is impossible to stabilize these experiences and take advantage of the opportunity they represent. To be able to recognize and use such moments of heightened intensity requires the firm foundation of a calm and steady mind, and confidence in the basic sanity and goodness of our own nature. Yeah, this is where the training comes in. Without it, at death, we're more likely to succumb to the uprushing of memories and fears and anxieties that are part of the entering the state. It's an intermediate state after death. Sesshin, Zazen, more broadly Zazen, but more commonly Sesshin, tests us in that, where we find ourselves on a roller coaster at first. Early Sesshin's a roller coaster of sometimes ecstasy down to discouragement and onto back up to giddiness or rapture, and then plunge back down into depression even, and all this just morphing from one state to another so quickly that we come to see that it's all empty. There's nothing to it. There's no substance to it. And having that experience over and over and over and over and over again, whether it's in Sesshin or sitting in Zazen on one's own, but seeing this parade of mind states enough times, then we come to see what is beyond it. And that is what enables us to enter any transition, whether it's death or divorce or financial collapse or anything else, with much greater equanimity. There's a line from a koan in the Mumonkan, number 35, "Say and her soul are separated," where Mumon says, "If you realize this one, or rather, if you realize the one, you will know that we pass from one husk to another like travelers stopping at an inn. But if this is not yet clear, don't rush about wildly. When earth, water, fire, and air suddenly separate, you'll be like a crab struggling in boiling water with its seven arms and eight legs. Don't say I didn't warn you." This reference to earth, water, and air, fire and air separating is normally would be taken as death at the end of one's life, the death experience. But again, it could be taken as any death, whether it's a passage of life, a loss, or a daily experience of letting go. Our salvation, to use a non-Buddhist word, our salvation, any such painful experience of transition is faith. It will make all the difference in how we pass through these things. Faith that there is the universe isn't making a mistake, that there isn't something, some injustice or something terrible happening. Painful, yes, maybe, but underneath it all, there is some order. There, or maybe better yet, there is some point to it, some possibility. That it can be used somehow. That nothing that happens to us it arises except through our own actions, in a way. Everything that happens to us is something, some truth that resonates with our innermost being. It's exactly what faith it is. It's exactly what we need to happen. As much as we may hate it, as painful as it may be, to have the faith that it's just what we need at that moment. This just takes a lot of faith when it's really painful. And one is in a state of great uncertainty and fear and anxiety, but this is where the rubber hits the road. This is where practice will enable us to summon this kind of faith, or as Dogen called it, Dogen said, those who would practice the Dharma must deeply, deeply believe in the passing nature of things and have faith in karma. Deeply, deeply believe the passing of nature of things. Whatever it is, whatever the condition or the state it is that we're transitioning from to, it's not going to be permanent. It's going to change. And it is just what we need at that moment. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.